Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit is now open according to law. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good afternoon. This is Judge Wilson. I'm in Tampa. Judge Luck is in Tallahassee. And Judge Rosenbaum is in Fort Lauderdale. And we're here for oral argument in Lyndon Fitzgerald Pace versus the Georgia Warden. And Gerald Wesley King, Jr. is here for the appellant Pace. And Sabrina Graham is here for the state of Georgia. And Mr. King, are you ready to proceed with your argument?
I am, Your Honor.
You may proceed.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Gerald King of the Federal Defender Program in Atlanta, Georgia, on behalf of Lyndon Pace. I'd like to focus my argument today on the first of our claims, the ineffective assistance of Mr. Pace's counsel at sentencing, and the second and third, which address the prosecution's misconduct during sentencing phase closing and counsel's ineffectiveness in failing to object to portions of that argument that were improper as a matter of state law. To address the ineffective assistance of counsel, first, unrebutted and overwhelming DNA evidence matched Mr. Pace to each of the four victims in this case. 4 months before trial, his counsel sent a psychologist, Dr. Dennis Herendeen, to do a quote-unquote light or drive-by screening to see if they could present a guilt phase defense of intellectual disability. This screening indicated that Mr. Pace had organic brain damage and borderline intellectual functioning and the need to rule out bipolar disorder, a major mental illness. Dr. Herendeen recommended further testing and evaluation. Counsel said they would get back to Dr. Herendeen. He never heard from them again. Had counsel obtained the full-scale testing that Dr. Herendeen recommended, they would have obtained, as this court said in Farrell, consistent, unwavering, compelling, and wholly unrebutted expert evidence that Mr. Pace suffered from significant permanent organic brain damage, clear subaverage intellectual functioning of an organic nature, and paranoid schizophrenia.
This is Judge Wilson, counsel. Doesn't the record in this case reflect that Dr. Herendeen advised Mr. Pace's counsel that he did not believe that a mental retardation claim would be viable, he did not think that that defense, that mental incapacity defense, was, in his words, promising, and that his IQ score did not reflect intellectual disability, and they took that into consideration in making a strategic decision to go with a different penalty phase defense? And why aren't we required to defer to the state court's finding on that? Don't we give the state court epideference on that specific finding?
Well, Your Honor, I think there are a few things going on there. The evaluation of Mr. Pace was limited by counsel, and all of the members of the defense team testified to this, to assess whether mental retardation was available as a guilt-innocence phase defense. And so Dr. Herendeen performed a screening instrument, and that's very important. Dr. Herendeen's, quote, light, unquote, drive-by screening is just that. It is a screening. It is not a comprehensive test. And the results of that were he estimated Mr. Pace's IQ at about 78. That's borderline intellectual functioning. That itself, by the way, according to the precedent of this court, is mitigating evidence, even if it did not amount to a guilt-innocence phase defense. And where we say that counsel's conduct was unreasonable and where the state habeas court erred in its adjudication otherwise is that no reasonable counsel is going to terminate their constitutionally required investigation into Mr. Pace's mental health at that juncture. They are not going to ignore the red flags of organic brain damage, intellectual disability, and major mental illness, which those screenings alerted them to. Now, when we look at counsel's decisions about when to terminate an investigation, we assess them for all of the circumstances. In this case, again, we have overwhelming DNA evidence. The unrebutted testimony at trial was that Mr. Pace was implicated in each of the four cases with a chance of a false positive being 1 in 500 million for three and 1 in 150 million for the other. So this is a case where, and to back up just slightly, this is a case where counsel, again, the defense team is consistent on this testimony, decided that a mitigating case, a case presenting the kind of mitigation that Dr. Herendeen's screening alerted them to, did not fit with their approach. And their approach, according to their testimony, was residual doubt. So they have opted to forego an investigation into these areas of mitigation that, again, as this court said in Farrell, are in compiling and assessing the Supreme Court precedent on this point, is incredibly powerful mitigating evidence. They're foregoing all of that in order to run a residual doubt defense premised upon these extremely large unlikelihood, virtual impossibility that Mr. Pace has been wrongly identified as the perpetrator.
Well, this is Judge Wilson again. These lawyers are pretty experienced. He had experienced lawyers and investigators who were working on this case who had experience with capital cases and made a strategic decision. But let's say that we accepted your argument that we should not give AEDPA deference to the Georgia court's findings on the on Strickland's performance prong. The facts in this case are pretty bad. This involved the murder of four elderly women, and the facts are pretty grisly. What can you tell us to convince us that the state court's finding on the prejudice prong of Strickland should not be given deference? These are pretty bad facts.
They are, Your Honor. They are bad.
And the evidence is overwhelming. These are four grisly, brutal murders and rapes of elderly women. I think your biggest hurdle is to convince us that on the prejudice prong of Strickland, that we should not defer to the state court's finding.
Yes, Your Honor, apologies. I just wanted to make sure that I didn't talk over you there. No, to speak to the state court's prejudice determination, well, actually, to address your point here, what Supreme Court case law has taught us, and we've cited Supreme Court cases and other cases in our brief, identifying cases that are also extremely aggravated in which penalty phase relief was granted for failure to investigate and present the kind of compelling evidence that we have here. The most important fact I want to highlight for Your Honor is that the jury in Mr. Pace's case sent a note out asking if they had the power to sentence him with life without parole. And as two justices in the Supreme Court of Georgia recognized, this indicates that death was not a foregone conclusion in this case, and that despite the facts of this case, death and the paucity of the penalty phase presentation, which we've not yet discussed, the jury was amenable to sentencing him to something other than death. And so we can't assume, even as terrible as the facts of this case are, we cannot assume that a death sentence was out of reach, particularly given, how powerful the mitigating evidence is here, organic brain damage, schizophrenia, borderline intellectual functioning, all categories of evidence the Supreme Court and this court have recognized again and again as mitigating.
That question by the jury supports a reasonable probability that the jury would have returned a recommendation of life instead of death?
I think it speaks to the point that you brought up specifically, Your Honor, which is whether the evidence in this case was so aggravating as to push the possibility of a sentence of other than death out of reach. And we know, again, from case law that is not the case, and we know from the facts here that the jury was, as the Supreme Court of Georgia said, the dissenting judges in the Supreme Court of Georgia said, pondering imponderables. And so
the state says that that question by the jury could support the contention that the jury seriously considered alternatives to the death penalty and decided that the death penalty recommendation was their choice.
Well, Your Honor, if that's the case, that just argues again for counsel's ineffectiveness and the prejudice to Mr. Pace from not presenting this powerfully mitigating evidence that would have enhanced the case that the jury evidently responded to. And I want to make this point. This is very important. Trial counsel said that their penalty phase theory was residual doubt. However, at the penalty phase, they instead pled mercy, essentially had members of Mr. Pace's family. Yes, Your Honor?
This is Robin Rosenbaum. I want to go back to the mitigation question for just a moment, if you don't mind.
Yes,
I just want to make sure I understand your point. I am understanding you to be arguing that when the initial Herendeen evaluation was done, it was done for purposes of determining whether under Georgia's statute, which prohibits execution of so-called mentally retarded individuals, whether for guilt purposes, or I guess, you know, capital punishment purposes, whether Mr. Pace could be eligible for that particular defense. In other words, on the guilt phase, not on the sentencing phase. And so once Dr. Herendeen concluded that he wasn't eligible for the so-called mental retardation exception to capital punishment, he also noted that there were some elevated factors and findings regarding schizophrenia and, in particular, delusions and hallucinations that he recommended that additional testing be done. But that would have been for the separate phase of the penalty phase. And at the penalty phase, there was no testing done at all, and the testing that had previously been done related only to a determination of whether Mr. Pace would be eligible under the Georgia statute of being relieved from the possibility of a death sentence. Am I misunderstanding?
No, Your Honor, that's correct. That's correct. And Dr. Herendeen was directed to screen for mental retardation as the guilt-innocence-based defense. And as you said, he administered a number of screening instruments. I want to flag to the court that even the IQ testing here is just a screening. It's a Shibley screening instrument where he estimates his IQ at about 78. He recommended further testing to counsel to explore the intellectual functioning that Mr. Pace had. He also administered, as you said, screenings that on many of the scales reflected unusual content, unusual responses indicating the presence of delusions. And the computer-generated scoring for this instrument actually said he needs to be evaluated for bipolar disorder, which is a major mental illness. But at that point, trial counsel walks away from the inquiry.
This is Robert Luck. I have a couple follow-up questions on that area there. First, as I understand it, the trial court, the state habeas court, did not find that there were any restrictive limitations on the mental health investigation. In fact, the court there found, as a matter of fact, that the investigation was reasonable under the circumstances of the case. That is what the state habeas court found, correct?
Your Honor, I don't think that's exactly right. They say that the court, I believe they say that counsel performed reasonably in eschewing further investigation because it would contradict their residual doubt theory.
All right. So, and as I understand it, there was some record. I know you mentioned a few times about the testimony of trial counsel. The trial counsel, in fact, testified that the purpose of hiring Dr. Herendeen was to determine whether there were any red flags regarding possible mental health issues, not just mental retardation. Is that correct?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe it is. And
all right, I'm quoting from docket entry 17-1, pages 46 and 47 of the record. Quote, this is summarizing Dr. Hendon's role and why he was hired. It was, quote, to determine whether or not there's any red flags that are raised with regard to possible mental health issues. Did counsel not testify to that?
I'm trying to get to the place in the record that you've indicated, Your Honor, and I might have to try to pull it up here and respond. The testimony of Mike Mears and Pam Leonard and Nancy Mao was that the screening was done for the purposes of ascertaining mental retardation, that the focus of the case all along was reasonable doubt based on overzealous prosecution.
Didn't counsel specifically state that it was to determine possible mental health issues and not mental retardation? Isn't that exactly what the testimony is? And let me direct you while we're doing that to someplace else. So as I understand it,
Your Honor, I apologize. Could you give me that first cite again? I just want to make sure.
I will in a second. It's docket entry 17-1, page 46 and 47. But secondly, with regard to, as I understand it, Ms. Leonard, who was the one who largely dealt with the doctor, she wrote up her conversation with the doctor as they were going through some of the evaluations. And what she wrote was specifically, quote, "I went to press Dennis being the doctor, to take a measured approach to psychological testing by doing some initial screening, then looking for correlates in the literature, i.e. scores in certain tests, often predicate scores in other tests, for guidance as to what additional tests to administer. He agreed fully with this approach and provided he had enough time and money to do so." That, in fact, is in the record, too, is it not?
That is in the record, and Dr. Herring did.
So, counsel, it's not limited to mental retardation. It was to psychological tests broadly, right?
Your Honor, I think that is contradicted by other places in the testimony of counsel.
Without a doubt, there are conflicts in the testimony. My question is, when given conflicts in the record, isn't the state habeas court allowed to make findings about the reasonableness of a mental health investigation and the scope of that investigation being reasonable, given the conflict?
But Your Honor, if there is a conflict, as you've identified, in what counsel said the purpose of these initial screenings was, the scope of the original screenings, there's no conflict that nothing else happened after that initial screening done by Dr. Herendeen.
Well, let's talk about that for a second, because as I understand it, The additional screening that Dr. Hendon wanted, or additional testing, was not related to schizophrenia at all, but instead was related to frontal lobe issues. In other words, he wanted to further evaluate and confirm the organic brain damage, right? Nothing to do with schizophrenia at all. Is that correct?
I don't think that is correct, Your Honor, because we're not saying, again, that the screening indicated schizophrenia specifically. We're saying that the screening showed elevations on a number of scales, including mania, including schizophrenia, and that specific responses to those screenings indicated delusions. And that, there's no doubt that that's true.
My question is simply, the additional testing that Dr. Herendon wanted, wasn't that related to frontal lobe damage related to the organic brain injuries, right?
Your Honor, I don't think it should be read that narrowly. I don't. I think that his line to Ms. Leonard is that he wanted to do full-scale testing to follow up on mental retardation, and that the results of other testing indicated that further evaluation should be pursued, and that the rule-out diagnoses generated by the PAI particularly were organicity and bipolar disorder.
Right.
So I don't think there's anything from the record to suggest that Dr. Herendeen was not recommending an inquiry into mental health. And indeed, the results of these screenings point towards wave red flags for delusions and a major mental illness. Yes, Your Honor.
I'd like to ask you a question. You mentioned, and I think the record is clear, that the state court found that counsel had opted against doing additional testing in favor of proceeding on a residual doubt theory. And I have to tell you, I went through the entire closing argument, and I did not see a single reference to residual doubt, but I may have missed it.
No.
Are you aware of what the court was referring to in terms of what actually was presented for argument with respect to residual doubt?
No, Your Honor, you are absolutely correct. There is nothing in the closing argument alluding to residual doubt, except, in fact, an apology to the jury from counsel because Mr. Pace's, some members of Mr. Pace's family said that they thought that he was innocent still, despite the evidence presented during the guilt-innocence phase. What counsel did during the penalty phase closing was to say to the jury, the case here is obviously very aggravated, but what would imposing a sentence of death say about you? And tried to work that angle. So the actual penalty phase case, despite counsel's protestations, was a mercy case. And really only that.
So is there any support in the record for the state court's conclusion that counsel, in fact, proceeded with a residual doubt defense?
Outside of counsel's testimony claiming that that was their theory, there is certainly nothing actually done to support it.
2 minutes, counsel. Your Honor, counsel, you have to.
Yes. And, Your Honors, I just want to flag that I know I have 2 minutes left, and I did want to address my claims 2 and 3. I'm happy to continue asking questions about claim 1, of course. But if I could pivot to claim 2 quickly during the penalty phase. Yes? I'm sorry, I thought I heard a question. The prosecutor's penalty phase closing directed the jurors to come with him to each of the victims' home in turn and imagine themselves experiencing what the victims had while luridly and graphically describing their rape and murder. This was 4 separate and improper golden rule arguments 2 justices of the Supreme Court would have reversed despite counsel's failure to object. He told the jury that...
Don't you get a little more... This is Judge Wilson again. These comments were made during the penalty phase rather than the guilt phase. Haven't we said before in our opinions that you get a little... Prosecutors get a little more latitude during the penalty phase than the guilt phase in making these sorts of arguments, which would include the golden rule argument and the other arguments that you mentioned in your brief?
Well, Your Honor, I would say that the prosecutor here took more than a little latitude. These are arguments that tick off all the concerns articulated in Darden, manipulating and misstating the evidence, implicating his right to remain silent. There's nothing
in some of these were not objected to, and others the court gave curative instructions.
Well, if I can address actually the failure to object on claim 3, looking at my clock and seeing 20 seconds.
We'll give you a little more time.
We have argued. All right. Well, yes, we've argued that trial counsel provided ineffective assistance for failing to object to these arguments that were clearly improper under Georgia law. And because of his failure to object, that misconduct was reviewed by a far more stringent standard than they would have been had he objected. In terms of the objections that counsel did make, counsel did object to a number of instances of misconduct. I think it's worth noting that in one of the most egregious ones, which is when the prosecutor uses the story of Jesus' crucifixion to comment on Mr. Pace's silence, the court and counsel can't even think of what a curative instruction could be. The court ultimately said that it was very close to the line, but accepted the prosecutor's, I would say from the record, frankly, pretextual claim that he was commenting not on Mr. Pace's exercise of his right to silence at trial, but that no members of his family had testified that he had expressed any kind of remorse. So I think when you're dealing with the scope of misconduct here, yes, Your Honor? I apologize for stopping. I'm hearing some crackling, and I wanted to make sure I wasn't talking over one of you. I think when you look at the scope of the misconduct here, it is far worse than Darden. It's worse than Parker. It ticks off all of the standards that this court has enumerated in Brooks, where this is misleading and prejudicial. It's not isolated. It's extensive. It's deliberate. Not accidental, as evidenced by the prosecutor repeatedly doubling down on the misconduct once there has been an objection, which, Judge Wilson, goes to your point, sometimes the objections just seem to spur the prosecutor to try even harder to prejudice the jury here. So we would argue that on their own dismissed this argument. We argued the prosecutorial misconduct merits sentencing phase relief on its own, and the trial counsel's failure to object, which resulted, again, in these claims being reviewed by a far more stringent standard, is also ground for relief. And seeing that I'm over my time, unless I have another question on these issues, I'll pop back up for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. King, and I think you have reserved some time for rebuttal.
Yes, sir.
And we'll hear from the state, Ms. Graham.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Sabrina Graham, and I am here on behalf of the warden asking that this court affirm the district court's denial of relief. And I apologize for the creaking. It's my chair. I hope you can't hear that. I'll start off with an ineffective assistance counsel claim regarding deficiency. I think it's important, and I don't know how to say this any more eloquently than this, that Mears, Mao, and Harvey are some of your most experienced death penalty litigators out there. They're being accused of not having investigated whether or not Mr. Pace was abused, neglected, or had mental health disorders. And that, to me, is like saying your most experienced neurosurgeon who goes in to do surgery doesn't bother to look for the tumor. I'm sorry. Sure.
This is Robin Rosenbaum. I understand your point, but even the most experienced among us make mistakes sometimes. And I don't think we can decide the case based purely on the experience level of the individuals involved. I think we have to look at the particular decisions they made in this case. And let me tell you what I am concerned about here. I am concerned that the entire mental health screening that was done in the context of determining whether Mr. Pace might be eligible for the Georgia exception to the death penalty under the so-called mental retardation exception. And once it was determined that he wasn't eligible for that, although Dr. Herendeen found elevated levels of certain things in screening, including delusions and hallucinations, and suspected organic brain damage, and told counsel this and even suggested following up and offered to do so, no further steps were taken and with respect to the sentencing phase as opposed to with respect to the guilt phase as to whether or not he, in fact, had any such damage. So that's my first concern. My understanding when I read through the state court discussion of this is that the state court did not find it problematic in any case because it concluded that counsel had made an affirmative determination to proceed instead under a residual doubt theory under the sentencing phase. And the problem is, when I look at what counsel actually did, it just does not line up with what counsel said he was doing. There's not a single mention of residual doubt that I could find in the closing argument. Maybe you can find it and you can help me with that, point me to where that would be. That would be very helpful to me. But in the absence of that, it seems to me that there might be some unreasonable fact-finding here on the part of the state court in this regard, and I wanted to give you an opportunity to respond to those things.
Sure. I'd like to lay out the record as I see it regarding trial counsel's decision regarding mental health screening. I do think that it was a mental health screening about more than just mental retardation, and I'd like to say that mental retardation could have been presented in the sentencing phase as well. But here you had Dr. Herendeen, who gave an affidavit who said, yes, he did intelligence testing, but he also did a neuro screen. And you have Mr. Mears testifying during his deposition that we would have done a mental health evaluation. We would have looked for anything to see if there were any red flags for mental health issues. He does not limit it to mental retardation. And, in fact, Mr. Mears also testified that, hey, I would have talked to Dr. Herendeen afterwards. I would have asked him about the evaluation, and he says at one point that Herendeen didn't turn up anything to change his approach. In addition to all of that, you also have the fact that trial counsel was in constant contact with Pace. You have the fact that they did spend extensive time with the family members and friends. You have them getting every kind of record they could on not only Pace, but his mother and his father. So they have a full picture here of what it was, what his life was like, and they chose, even after Harry said that, they chose not to go forward with that. I think that's a reasonable decision when you look at the totality of the circumstances and the totality of the record. And I'm not saying that Mr. Mears shouldn't be found ineffective just because he's so experienced. It just, it doesn't make sense to me that he would not have gone forward in these things if he didn't see something there. That, I mean, he gives, you know, lectures on this, and so that doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, lots of times when we make mistakes, they don't make sense, and that's why they're mistakes.
Sure.
But, I mean, really, I'm not trying to be flippant, but let me ask you.
I'm sorry.
No, can you focus for a moment for me on the residual doubt issue here? Where can I find any kind of indication in the actual trial record itself that Mr. Mears and the defense here proceeded on a residual doubt theory at the sentencing phase?
I can point you to one thing he said in his closing argument during the sentencing phase, but first I'd like to say that Mr. Mears said that their theory going into trial, when he testified at his deposition, their theory going into trial was going to be residual doubt, and they felt like they had a good reasonable doubt defense there to begin with, because they felt first DNA evidence was new, so they could point out as unreliable science, and it didn't go in unrebutted as petitioner claims. It actually was the experts were cross-examined by Bruce Harvey at trial extensively. In addition to that, they also wanted to show prosecutorial aggressiveness. They were overzealous, and they felt like they had other avenues there during the guilt innocence phase they could follow up on to show that he was not guilty. However,
okay,
Mr. Mears,
at the sentencing phase, I'm sorry to interrupt, it's just, you know, with these telephone things, it's hard to take visual cues, obviously, so I apologize. But with respect to the sentencing phase, which is what we're concerned about here, where can I find evidence that he actually engaged in a residual doubt defense?
And that's what I was getting to. I'm sorry, I'm being long-winded. He said it just didn't pan out in the guilt phase like they wanted it to. The evidence did not pan out, so they weren't left with this big reasonable doubt they thought they were going to be left with. And so in trial counsel's, Mr. Mears' closing argument, he says to the jury, you know, this is what he says. He says, and this is on page 5623 of his closing argument. I'm sorry, I don't have the federal site. He says, I think it would have been hypocritical for us to argue as we did and strongly, and we have argued that the evidence didn't prove him not guilty. You made that decision. But how stupid would it have been to come in and say, well, you found him, we have, he is not guilty, but we say he's crazy anyway. So to me, they're sort of trying to back off of that and say, you know, we said he's not guilty. They're still not saying he's guilty, but we're not going to try and put up in something and say that's opposite of what's guilt, that he's not guilty.
Do we have to look at the closing argument by defense counsel if we were to conclude that the penalty phase defense was not residual doubt, but it was merely a mercy defense? Is there anything else in the state court record that would reflect that that the defense was a residual doubt rather than a mercy defense?
I can't point you to anything particular in the sentencing phase, and I just read it, other than to
counsel,
say...
Counsel, this is Robert Luck, and I'm sorry to interrupt, but I think this goes to what Judge Wilson is asking. Didn't, in fact, as I count, at least four or five of the witnesses at the penalty phase specifically state that they believed in the innocence of Mr. Pace and that he could not have done it based on their knowledge of him and their understanding of the facts, including some of his brothers and sisters who sat through the entire trial? Wasn't that in evidence?
Yes, absolutely, and they did testify to that.
Counsel, there's no reason to do that if you're not making a residual guilt defense. or residual doubt defense, right?
I think that's fair, yes, Your Honor.
And then one other thing I want to point to, is it not true that the jury instructions specifically call for the jury not just to consider in its penalty phase deliberations the testimony that's brought out in the penalty phase, but in fact specifically says that they are to consider that testimony that was brought out in the guilt phase, including those things that attack reasonable doubt?
Correct, yes. Yes.
Let me ask you a question, though, concerning that, because at first when I looked at that questioning, I thought, oh, okay, well, there's residual doubt. But then when I looked at the actual closing argument, it looks like counsel argues just the opposite, because he says, ignore that they said that. Of course they're going to say that they're his relatives. And you can't really hold it against Pace that they still think he's innocent because they're his relatives. So, of course, they're going to think the best of him. So, to me, that is the exact opposite of arguing residual doubt. Maybe I missed something here, but maybe you can tell me how that lines up with a residual doubt argument.
I don't think it's counter to the residual doubt argument. I think that has something to do with what goes on at trial. You have trial counsel standing there, and he's looking at the jury, and he sees their reactions. And when Mr. Mears testified in state habeas, he said that when the family testified that he didn't do it, it came across as belligerent. And perhaps he felt like he needed to shore that up with the jury and say, and that's why he did it, not because he wasn't saying there was no residual doubt there. I think it was just a strategy that was born from, you know, looking at the jury and the trial. Mr. Mears doesn't say that, but that, to me, seems to be a logical conclusion there. Did I answer the question?
I mean, I think you've answered it the best you can. I don't understand how arguing not to listen to what they said and not to hold it against his client when they said that they thought he was innocent support a theory of residual doubt. But, you know, I don't know. It doesn't seem to support it to me.
Well, even if this court were to find that counsel performed deficiently or that the state habeas court, in fact, their deficiency finding wasn't entitled to deference, and you drop down to prejudice, I don't think you can say that no reasonable jurist would have determined in this particular case there wasn't prejudice. I mean,
so let me ask you this about that, and I will tell you, when I first read through this record, I mean, it is a horrifying, horrific record. And so there is this initial gut reaction where you think to yourself, well, how could there be prejudice here? You know, the jury, of course, is going to reach this conclusion. But I think there are two things that might suggest otherwise. First, of course, is the note from the jury where they ask if life imprisonment without parole is a possibility. I mean, that's not something that you frequently see in these death penalty cases. I've worked on enough of them to know that I have not often seen that. So that in and of itself, to me, suggests that the jury, or at least some members of it, were having some doubts about whether they really wanted to impose the death penalty. And second, if in fact the mental health information had come in, and specifically I'm talking about the fact that it seems pretty clear that this guy was suffering from delusions and hallucinations and schizophrenia, at least as far back as 1995, which was at the time of the trial, I think for those of us who have seen people who suffer deeply with these kinds of problems, you know, I think that might have had an effect on the jury in deciding whether it wanted to recommend execution or instead recommend life imprisonment. And I think it's hard to be able to quantify exactly what effect that would have had. So I don't know if you want to address those two things, but I don't think we can say it's a done deal that there was no prejudice here when you look at the actual record.
Well, yes. First, I would like to say that it's not about whether there's no prejudice. It's about whether or not the state court reasonably determined that there was no prejudice. And regarding your first issue of the note where they sent out, does this really mean, you know, life without parole or whatever, I've seen that in several of our death penalty cases, and I think that's come up in a couple of cases before this court as well, not too long ago. I'm happy to do a supplemental on that, but certainly I've seen that doesn't seem to be...
No, you don't have to do a supplemental on that. My point with that is simply that you don't see that all the time, and I'm sure that you've seen it in other cases, but it doesn't mean that you see it in every case. It's not the kind of question that you see in every single case. And it's not the kind of question that appears in the majority of these types of cases. I mean, exactly how many it appears in is not really the point. The point is that it's clear that the jury was at least thinking about that as an alternative.
Well, we don't know if they were thinking about that as an alternative or if they just generally wondered if you ever got out of prison, if you have a life sentence. I mean, there's no – I mean, that's assigning a meaning to their question that's not there. I'm sorry.
Let me ask you this. Why would you ask the question about whether life without parole was a permissible alternative if you intended to sentence someone to death? Because it becomes completely irrelevant.
Well, I don't think it becomes completely irrelevant. I mean, they were there to determine whether or not he gets life or whether or not he gets death. Maybe it was just, you know, something in the fancy in somebody's mind, like, hey, well, look, does it really mean he's going to stay in prison? That doesn't mean that they were seriously considering not giving him the death penalty. I mean, there's no way to find the importance of it.
Let me ask you something. If you were the jury and you were going to decide death, because this, I mean, I agree with you. This is an absolutely heinous crime. So if you were going to decide death on that basis, then what would it matter to you whether a person who got life in prison could be paroled or not? Because you're deciding death. So it's irrelevant, and it makes no difference. Who cares if everybody else, you know, who's been sentenced to life imprisonment can get parole because Pace can't if you're going to sentence him to death. So it seems to me the only reason to ask the question is because you're seriously entertaining the possibility of sentencing him to life if you are under the impression that it will be without the possibility of parole.
And I would just respectfully disagree and say the jury could ask questions for any number of reasons. We don't know exactly why they asked that particular question. We're assigning a reason to it, but that may not be why they did. But to go on to the prejudice issue, I would like to say even if you took this new information that he had and you put it up, I think, first of all, you have a lot of credibility issues there. You have a family telling, as the state habeas court said, one...
Counsel, Robert Luck, I want to ask about that a little bit. Is it mitigating, as a matter of law, is it mitigating if I have a serious mental health issue 7 years or 6 years after I commit the crime? In other words, does it tell the jury that it mitigates the what I did and my eligibility for the death penalty if I have a psychological illness 7 years after that crime happened? And to the extent it is at all mitigating as a matter of law, how weak or strong is that mitigating evidence?
Okay, no, I do not think that it, as a matter of law, that it is mitigating for that particular crime, for the crime that they have committed. And I would...
But is it a mitigating factor to be considered for the sentence? And if it's not, and you know, maybe you're well right about this, what is your authority for that position?
Sure, I think what I'm saying is... From what I understand, Judge Luck is saying, you got a diagnosis 7 years after trial that you have schizophrenia, but you don't have a diagnosis. They're not saying at the time of the crime you had schizophrenia. So would that mitigate that particular crime? No, because your diagnosis came after. But I assume what you're saying, Judge Rosenbaum, is assume that he could have gotten a schizophrenic diagnosis then based upon the evidence that he presented in state habeas, and would that have given proven prejudice? And I say absolutely not there either, because first of all, you have a credibility determination by the district court finding that it was not convinced that he in fact suffered from schizophrenia, and that's a fact finding and a credibility finding. Secondly, you have a whole host of issues that go into the credibility of the schizophrenia diagnosis. First, you have the family giving one narrative at trial, and as the state habeas court said, giving another narrative in state habeas, which means then that you have a credibility with your historians. And the mental health experts' evaluation and their diagnosis are based upon the credibility of their historians. Here you have a big issue there. Secondly, you have a different diagnosis by the there at the prison regarding him. Third, you have the fact that these mental health experts never once mention the crime. They never once talk about the facts of the crime. They never talk about asking him about the facts of the crime. How do we know what he was suffering from then? You also have a person who was on drugs. I'm not saying you can't be schizophrenic and use drugs.
But speaking of that, the reason that we know he was on drugs, at least in significant part, and was using crack cocaine, is because of the testimony of Jerry Johnson. But the defense team was unaware of the testimony of Jerry Johnson because they never talked to Jerry Johnson before or during the penalty phase of the trial. So, you know, I mean, I think that there are a whole lot of issues here. Plus, by the way, you know, the state trial court made a lot of errors in saying what the evidence was. It said, for example, that defense counsel was aware of Jerry Johnson, and all of the was not true. They said that Mr. Shapiro, a psychologist or a psychiatrist, when he was a statistician, there are a number of these kinds of errors in the state court decision when it reached the conclusion that a proper mitigation investigation has been held. I don't know if you want to speak to any of those, but I want to bring them to your attention.
Sure. And I would say regarding – I was talking about prejudice, but regarding the deficiency prong, you have the CPC opinion by the Georgia Supreme Court, and in the CPC opinion, they specifically state – and I will quote, after independently reviewing the trial record and the habeas record, we conclude that while the habeas court erred in some instances in considering the effect of counsel's alleged sentencing phase deficiencies on the jury's finding of guilt rather than its selection of a sentence in determining whether the petitioner has shown the necessary prejudice to constitute ineffective assistance at the sentencing phase of trial, the habeas court did not err in finding that Pace has failed to show that counsel's sentencing phase performance in those instances was deficient under constitutional standards, and there's no arguable merit to the petitioner's ineffective assistance of counsel claims. So what I would say there is you have the Georgia Supreme Court doing its own independent review, and then when we look at the Wilson versus Sellers, it says, although you look through a summary opinion, that's just a presumption that the higher court is relying upon those particular findings. But that can be rebutted if it's something obvious in the record. Well, here we have the Georgia Supreme Court saying, we're not looking, we think the state court made some wrong findings there, but still we find he hasn't shown ineffective assistance of counsel. So that's
Counsel, as you noted earlier, the investigation was seemed to be very thorough. They gathered every single document with Mr. Pace's name on it and his mother's name on it and his father's name on it and his family's name on it. They talked to every single sibling. They talked to family friends that were given to them by there. They talked to Mr. Pace and asked him specifically about his background and experience. They talked to his ex-girlfriend. So clearly they were interested in relationships. Was there any indication that Mr. Johnson had a relationship with Mr. Pace that would have led them to believe that he had information that would have been mitigating or aggravating in any way?
No, I could find nothing in the record showing that that trial counsel were told about Mr. Johnson. I did find one note in the record where they were interviewing Mr. Pace and they asked him, hey, who was your roommate? And he says, oh, I don't remember his name, but he knows this other guy. I knew him through this other guy. So I don't even see where Pace told him about that. And going back to Judge Rosenbaum's questions regarding the drug use, he had been arrested for drug use and had to go in for drug screenings for that. So we do know that he did use drugs, and he did tell counsel that he used drugs. So it wasn't that counsel didn't know that he used drugs. It's that they didn't know that he was doing crack every weekend with his Mr. Johnson. So that's a different issue. And back to the prejudice argument, looking at the schizophrenia here, it just, to me, I don't see how that mitigates what he did. What he did was so volitional. I mean, he scoped out these ladies' houses. He broke into their houses. And one of them, he sat on top of her while he took her shoe and took the shoestring out to strangle her with it. I mean, everything about his crime showed that he knew exactly what was going on. When he broke in and he robbed the Barrett sisters, he didn't act like he was in a fugue state or he didn't know what was going on. He said to them, hey, when are your parents coming home? What color is their car? If you tell anybody, I will hurt you. I think he said the hurt you. He may not have said the hurt you part. He cut their phone lines. So the stuff he did doesn't – I just don't see an explanation from these mental health experts regarding how schizophrenia was affecting him regarding these particular crimes. I'm not saying it's not mitigating evidence. I'm just saying that it doesn't get a lot of weight, and I don't think it's unreasonable for a court not to give it a lot of weight.
And he broke into the home. The record reflects that there was evidence during the penalty phase that he broke into the home of Coretta Scott King and attempted to rape her. And isn't that sort of prejudicial? That seems clearly intended to inflame.
I did not see that. I know that he broke into Cronoscott King's home, but I didn't see in here whether I didn't see any evidence suggesting that he attempted to rape her. He said he saw her. There was no evidence that he attempted to rape her.
But the evidence at the sentencing hearing was that he broke into her home and they lifted fingerprints from her home.
Correct. They did. It was a window. They lifted the fingerprints from there, and that was extensively litigated during the sentencing phase. And he also pled guilty to the crime. And the trial court, they called in not the trial court, but defense counsel called in Mr. Purvis, who was his counsel during the plea negotiations. And he talked about what happened during the plea negotiations. And the person who took the plea was actually former Justice Sears. And they explained how they did that, and she didn't find that counsel was ineffective. So you have a plea, and you have fingerprints there.
And okay. I mean, I could be wrong about that, but my recollection of that evidence was that that Coretta Scott King was not home at the time, but that the prosecutor suggested it was a good thing because otherwise she would have been raped as well. But maybe I'm remembering that wrong. That could be.
I don't remember. Because there was so much stuff in there. I remember him stating, which his statements I don't think came in the sentencing phase, but he told them that she was sitting there, she was in the bed, she was reading, and I do believe, I mean, somebody said that, and, I mean, he said that, and somebody at trial said that. I just don't remember if it was in the part where they admitted the evidence or if it was in the part where they litigated whether the information should come in or not, but... Yes, I mean, he did say she was there.
Okay.
But
and there
regardless,
was, and
the, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, regardless of whatever count the district attorney may have said during his closing arguments, the trial court was very clear before counsel argued that whatever they said was not evidence, and then afterwards they charged the court that whatever they said in their argument wasn't evidence.
But regardless of that, I think it's clear that the prosecutor here made several, and regardless of whether it justifies in and of itself granting of the petition, I think it's very clear that the prosecutor here made several inappropriate and really outrageous remarks. And you know, I would hope that in any case that the state of Georgia would instruct its prosecutors that this type of conduct is not appropriate. I mean, it really is offensive what he did and said, knowing full well that the Georgia Supreme Court has prohibited such types of statements. For example, the Golden Rule stuff, but there is the ethnic rage cartoon. I mean, the religious thing, trying to, you know, use that. I mean, there's just so much of it here. The sodomy remark about, well, you know, he likes anal sodomy, so put him in jail. I mean, it was outrageous. And if for no other reason than just for appropriate instruction, I hope that the Georgia Attorney General's office will instruct its prosecutors that this is not appropriate and is not going to be tolerated.
Oh, certainly, Judge Rosenbaum, if we ever speak at a prosecuting attorney counsel thing, we always say, look, be very judicious in your statements during closing and opening, closing argument and opening statements. And we're not, I just would like to, again, drop back and say here, we're looking at whether or not the state court, the Georgia Supreme Court's decision was unreasonable under Supreme Court precedent. And when you look at Darden and the purpose of the AEDPA, Darden is a very broad standard, and they have
counsel,
a very hard...
you have 2 minutes.
Okay, thank you.
2 minutes,
And they have a very high standard to come under there, and whatever the prosecutor may have said, it just really pales in comparison to the crimes in this particular case.
Well, see, that's one of the problems. I agree with Judge Rosenbaum that the comments by the prosecutor were just outrageous, and I guess my question is, how do we disincentivize prosecutors if we don't grant writs of habeas corpus when their behavior is outrageous, even though the evidence in the case is overwhelming? I mean, if the evidence is overwhelming, there's no there's no disincentive for a prosecutor to just have at it with improper comments during their closing argument, because they know that the petition for writ of habeas corpus is going to be denied.
I don't know that they know that it's going to be denied, and I don't think the purpose of the AEDPA is to determine whether or not we should disincentivize, or I'm sorry, I'm saying that word wrong, the prosecutors. I think here is to determine whether or not the state court made a reasonable decision under Supreme Court precedent, and in this particular case, we would say that they did, and part of that is because the facts of the crime are so aggravated.
Well, let me ask you one more question before you conclude. If I could go back to the note by the jury asked about the possibility of life without parole. What did the judge tell the jury?
The judge told the jury, he gave them a proper instruction. He informed them that they were not to consider that they were to assume that a life sentence meant a life sentence. And I'm paraphrasing, obviously, but that's what the court said.
Okay.
So he gave a proper charge. There was no improper. He gave a proper charge.
Counsel, this is Robert Luck. Didn't he say, quote, the trial judge said, quote, you shall not consider the question of parole. Your deliberations must be limited to whether this defendant shall be sentenced to death or whether he shall be sentenced to life in prison. You
Correct.
Shall assume that your sentence, whichever it may be, will be carried out. Under our law, life imprisonment means that the defendant will be sentenced to incarceration for the remainder of his natural life. He essentially told them that it is life in prison is life in prison, right?
Correct. He did. So if they were truly considering that particular sentence and they were told he would be in prison for the rest of their life, they still did not give him that. They still
right,
chose the death penalty.
Which is how we know that it didn't ultimately affect the decision. It was just a question of curiosity.
Correct. Yes. So unless there are any further questions, I know I'm over time, I would, again, just ask that this court affirm the district court's denial of relief. And thank you very
All
much.
Right. Thank you, Ms. Graham. We'll hear from Mr. King. You've reserved some time for rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. Just to start from the back, I guess.
Well, Mr. King, this is Judge Wilson. And what
yes,
I'm hung up on, I'm hung up on prejudice. And if the judge gave the jury an appropriate instruction, don't we presume that the jury follows the judge's instruction?
Sir, I want to make, as to what issue, I apologize.
The jury asked the court about life, about the possibility of life without parole, and the court advised the jury, if I understood Ms. Graham correctly, that if he was sentenced to life, he would spend the rest of his life in prison. So obviously when the jury asked that question, they just wanted to make sure that even if they did not recommend the death penalty, that they recommended life imprisonment, that this guy would never get out. And the judge instructed them that, and they still chose a recommendation of death. And if that's the case, I'm hard-pressed to determine how that note establishes that there would be a reasonable probability of a different outcome if counsel was not deficient in the penalty phase of this case.
Well, Your Honor, I think that gets to the fifth of the issues that we had a certificate of appealability on, and I had not – hello?
Is that the only thing that establishes prejudice, the jury's note?
I'm sorry.
Is there anything
no,
else?
No, I don't think so. I think that we can look at the nature of the mitigating evidence here that was unavailable, and we can look at other cases in which there was a great deal of aggravation, but in which mitigating evidence of this type, which, again, to refer to your language in Farrell, consistent, unwavering, unrebutted mental health evidence, that is powerfully mitigating, and even in cases perhaps where there was no jury note, I don't concede that that was the meaning of the note, and I know the two justices of the Supreme Court of Georgia interpreted it that way, then we still can get to a place where death is not a foregone conclusion. And I mean, the Supreme Court in Andrus just last week said, you know, we have to be careful in doing these kinds of comparative where we look to precedent and say, like, here's where the bar is, unless you think that the mitigation is above this bar, relief is unavailable, or the flip side of that, I would argue that if a case is aggravated to a certain point, what you have to do here is the prejudice analysis that the Supreme Court has laid out. You take all of this mitigating evidence that was adduced in the state habeas proceedings. You add it to what was there in trial, and occasionally that means subtracting aggravating evidence, as was the case here, where many aggravating aspects of counsel's presentation would have been negated by this evidence. And I think prejudice here requires focusing on what this mental health evidence, the organic brain damage evidence, the borderline intellectual functioning evidence said about Mr. Pace. And to get to part of what was covered during when Ms. Graham was up, there is testimony from Dr. Dudley that at the time of the crimes, he was in an acutely psychotic phase of schizophrenia, and that compromised his perceptions, judgments, and behaviors. And he is suffering from delusions that are almost the textbook definition of a schizophrenic brain. And they're also the negative.
Counsel, this is Robert Luck. What do we do with the negative credibility finding regarding Dr. Dudley found by the state habeas court?
Your Honor, I'm not sure we can characterize that as a credibility finding. Dr. Dudley did not testify before this judge. Respondent did not depose him or call him to testify. I think what we have here is the judge discounting Dr. Dudley's testimony in contravention of Porter based upon a concern about his methodology, the failure to acknowledge the difficulty of a retrospective investigation that is not something required for the type of investigation that he was doing. So I think actually we're not doing a credit.
Doesn't also go to the inconsistency with some of the Department of Corrections records about the 2001 evaluation and finding delusions, but not necessarily schizophrenia, and also his original intake forms showing that he didn't have any of the symptoms of schizophrenia?
No, Your Honor, I think Dr. Dudley and Dr. Nestor accounted for the 2001 diagnosis, and I think it's worth noting that in 2001, Mr. Pace is writing to the FBI and a Fulton County judge to say that his family is in danger of being kidnapped and tortured or killed at the prison in an attempt to extort money from him and other prisoners. And he was
Didn't the prison also note that he was talking to himself and hearing voices and things of that nature? So those would be objective findings that are not subjective in any way. Isn't that right?
That's correct. And also, I think this is important, Dr. Dudley and Dr. Nestor accounted for that diagnosis and explained why they believed that schizophrenia was the more correct of the diagnoses, the screening it's also erroneous to say, as was said below, that the prison doctor, Dr. Beecham, said that his issues had resolved. He said that Mr. Pace continued to be delusional but refused treatment. And the screening instrument, which is performed by a counselor and relies on self-reporting, we would argue is incorrect and does not controvert or contradict that testimony of Dr. Dudley and Dr. Nestor, which explicitly accounted for it. So much to cover. Judge Luck, you asked me specific questions about two items in the record, which I retrieved. The first part that you were asking me to review is from Mr. Mears' deposition, I believe, it might actually be his testimony, but he's testifying on 17-1-46 that it is a common practice, in his opinion, for counsel to have or should have a client evaluated to determine whether or not there's any red flag. I would submit that here it's clear from context he's speaking generally and not about this case.
Look at the paragraph right above it. I think I mentioned this in my affidavit, that we did have him evaluated to determine whether or not we needed to pursue further mental health investigation in this case, right?
Yes, Your Honor, but if you look at his affidavit, which is 14-2, page 95, he says that the evaluation was not directed at determining this type of mental illness, and that's a quote. And I agree there is a conflict here in the testimony, but there's no conflict in the record about what counsel did not do next, which is the follow-up testing and evaluation that Dr. Herring did.
But in counsel, it can't be said that the focus, at least there's some evidence in the record, that the focus was not exclusively on mental retardation as it went to guilt and innocence phase, correct?
That is a post hoc justification offered by counsel. I would argue that the critical piece
I was merely asking if there's some evidence.
What they do next.
Counsel, I was merely asking if there's some evidence in the record. Is there?
Oh, yes. There's a conflict in the evidence as to what, in those documents that you say, there's a conflict in Mr. Beer's testimony as to the purpose of the screening, not what they did next. There's no dispute that they did not do the evaluation that Dr. Herendeen recommended. I apologize. I see I'm out of time. If I could say quickly as to the penalty phase closing arguments, Judge Rosenbaum, I regret to say the misconduct here has been tolerated by every court that has reviewed it. And indeed, unless this court were to intervene, I don't see what would prevent further horrific display like we saw in the penalty phase closing of this case. As soon as he says Mr. Pace would enjoy prison because of anal sodomy, we're not in court anymore. There's none of the dignity and respect for these proceedings that Welland says is required. And so we would ask the court to reverse and grant habeas relief for Mr. Pace. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Ms. Graham.
Thank you.
And that concludes the argument in this case. Court is adjourned.